You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings. We have a great show for you today, as always. And I think today we're going to talk about the Second Chance Act. Is that right?
Yeah.
And
before we jump into that, I want to do a little PSA. So, you know, we obviously get emails. We get contacted through Facebook Messenger. And occasionally we get letter mail. And probably it's not the best form if a incarcerated individual is sending us an email message or a Facebook message because they're doing it from an illegal cell phone because they don't have that access through the CoreLink service. But when you're sending letter mail, you know, if you have a legitimate issue, we're going to probably ask you to follow up and have your family contact us. But sending a letter asking us for help and then kind of weirdly being inappropriate and asking for to come visit because you're lonely, it's probably not a really smart decision. And I'm sharing this because it happened this week, and I'll be reaching out to the institution's SIS office because it was highly inappropriate. And while Bruce and I are both retired, we still follow the rules. We are born and bred BOP, so understand that's not appropriate. Just saying.
No, nobody asked me to go to jail and visit them. Anyway, kidding. It's a joke. It's terrible. And again, we have federalprisonauthority.com. We have a website. We actually, right here is the brick and mortar office for that here in Dallas, Texas at 11551 Forest Central Drive, Suite 211, Dallas, Texas. It's on the website. Send your snail mail here, right? Because I'll get it. Susan and I will process it electronically, as in like this, but different, like on a closed circuit line. And I can scan and email Susan, and we can process your issues and concerns in a very timely and professional way, mailing to the office here in Dallas, Texas.
Yeah.
Not mail it anywhere else for fear of consequences. So
absolutely. Someone's going to find that out the hard way. All right. So let's get on track with SCA. So, you know, we have been so busy, or I should say the Bureau's been busy, right? Generating a lot of press announcements, a lot of new policies. And we've been hitting that, the last four or five shows. And so we were talking about like doing some viewer questions. We like to pull questions from the Facebook group because if one person's asking, you know, chances are there's a lot of people with the same thoughts. And as we were pulling it through, we noticed there was a lot of questions just on traditional halfway house, the logistics of it. How long does referrals take? When are referrals, should recommendations be made? And oddly enough, these are all the topics that we talk about in our new book, which we affectionately refer to as the Red Book, which Bruce doesn't have. That's okay. He's holding it. It's at the other, it's at home. But it's Unlocking Federal Halfway House and Home Confinement Under the Second Chance Act. And so we thought we'd tackle some of these questions, but, and they're all great questions. So we kind of want to go through these, and I wrote them down in the order they appeared on the Facebook page, but I am going to jump around a little bit so that it makes a little bit more sense in terms of that. So, there were two FSA questions, and the FSA questions are important from the standpoint of understanding and following that SCA always stacks with, that is the book. That's our Red Book. It is available on Amazon. But SCA, Second Chance Act placement, which is the traditional halfway house placement. It is not, Second Chance Act is not earned. It's not, you don't get it because you were programming or because you were clear conduct. It is a needs-based reentry. It is the statutory authority for which the Bureau is allowed by Congress to allow someone to finish the last portion of their placement of their incarceration in community-based placement, whether that's halfway house or home confinement. So FSA, Second Chance Act, any recommendation stacks on top of any FSA. So always understanding that the FSA kind of sets that foundation and then the SCA builds on top of that. So there was just two quick questions on FSA. Well, that was strictly FSA. One of them had to do with credit from prior terms of incarceration. If you come back to custody, you release, you serve your time. This particular question came because the individual had previously, the loved one had previously been in custody, but at the time they were medium risk. They did their time, they earned credit, but they were never able to apply it. Then the next question was, okay, I'm back on a violation. Can I use my credit? Hard no. The credit is, it's a hard no. The credit is strictly based on the time remaining to serve for the current term of incarceration. It's way the law is written. So there is no time on the shelf. If you had it, it's not like overserve time where maybe your sentence changed and you get an immediate release, but you actually served more time than you would have if the sentence reduction happened a little quicker. In those cases, when there's overserved time, you do have time on the shelf. And that time on the shelf, if you come back to custody, can be applied to that new term. That is not the case with FSA. So hard no there. The other question that was specifically an FSA question is there a certain date FSA days are posted on the BOP website? So the first thing you need to know is the BOP website date always lags. So if your loved one's date changed today, inside, it changed yesterday or the day before. It's more than full 24 hours, but it's somewhere in that 36 hour-ish range, sometimes a little more, but there's always a lag. So always remember that. But then secondly, the Bureau last summer updated the actual calculator to analyze each individual. So before then, the last full weekend of the month, the calculator was being run for everybody. What's being done now is every person is being checked every day. And when you hit your 30 days, that's when your credit is posting. So it's an individual, you've gotten 30 days of programming, you get your time credits. Now, it's not 30 calendar days. It is 30 programming days.
Programming days.
Right. So hypothetically, if you went out to the local hospital because you decided to have appendicitis and needed to get your appendix out, I always use that example because that's what happened to me. I woke up one morning feeling bad, went to the emergency room instead of work, and ended up getting admitted for a few days. Surprise. That can happen. But as we know, if you are in an outside of the institution for a full 24 hours, for a full 24 hour day, that's a programming day. So if you had an emergency appendectomy in this 30 day period and you were out of the institution two full calendar days, it doesn't matter that there's 30 calendar days, there was only 28 programming days. If you got in trouble and got 14 days of DS, DS is disciplinary segregation, is non-programming days. You are in opt-out status, not in programming status. So again, if this was this 30-day interval, and in the middle of that 30-day calendar interval, you had a 14-day disciplinary segregation, well, then you don't have 30 programming days. You actually have 16 programming days. So those are something to always remember. Typically, no issues are coming up. Every 30 days, the person is getting their credit posted. If issues come up, it bumps those days because it's programming days, not calendar days. So those are just kind of two basic FSA questions. Thought they were very good questions. In fact, I think the one about prior credit is the first time we've seen that question. As I recall, I haven't seen that before on the Facebook page. So it was a good question. So let's dive into SCA Halfway House. So one of the questions, or actually a couple of the questions, centered around when should all of this get started? When should my unit team be talking to me about a recommendation, right? The unit teams, and this is newer, this changed last year. The unit teams are to be using those conditional FSA dates. And it's 17 to 19 months prior to the conditional date. So, but if a case manager is newer or not paying attention and they're just looking at the current release date and they go, oh, we'll review you when you're 17 to 19 months from release. They need to be looking at that conditional release date, not the current release date. What is on the Bureau website is the individual's current release date. That is the date with good conduct time and earned FSA time. The conditional release date includes that earned FSA time plus the unearned FSA time. And that's the date they're to be using, right? Now, where does this become challenging? Individuals with shorter sentences. Because you walk in the door, you go to your first team, and all you have is your good conduct time date. Then depending on your sentence, you come back in 3 or 6 months, or I'm sorry, 90 or 180 days, right? At 90 days, oh, your FSA time has kicked in, except it's only kicked in at the 10-day rate, right? And what happens? Oh, well, now the case manager has an FSA conditional date, but guess what? It's going to change because when the individual goes to the 15-day rate, the conditional release date is recalculated and generates a new earlier date. Does that kind of impact the timeline? 100%, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we do for our clients is we do that kind of manual calculation, not kind of, it's a manual calculation. We calculate exactly when they're going to go, presuming nothing happens, that they're getting all their programming days, but we give them those dates. We calculate, when are you going to go to 15 days? Because honestly, when you go to 10 days, doesn't matter. Unless you have just a super short sentence, a little 6 month sentence, and you're not going to benefit from the 15 days, right? But anyone else needs to know what their release date is when they get to the 15 day mark. So we calculate that. We let our clients know when they're going to, what date is it going to appear, when they're going to be eligible, when's it going to post internally, and what conversations they should be having with their case manager and how to have it. And we kind of, we create, I call it an incarceration map. I don't know if that's the best word for it, but I call it a map, and it really identifies those dates along your time of incarceration. When should halfway house be discussed? In a typical timeline. A typical timeline meaning the by policy timelines can be followed without any alteration because the person's sentence is long enough to get to the 10 days, get to the 15 days, get a conditional release date, and they're still 17 to 19 months out. But what if you have a shorter sentence? That's when you need to be aware of when these dates happen. So yes, 17 to 19 months in advance of the earliest conditional release date, or I'm sorry, the earliest conditional date for folks with longer sentences that are earning both time toward early release and early pre-release. Again, FSA and SCA are stacked time. So the unit teams should be looking at the earliest placement date, that earliest conditional date, to then make a recommendation. These timelines and understanding the dates are so critical. Go ahead, Bruce. Sorry.
We had a call this morning where the person now, the change of district, they're running out of time. They should have been more on top of it. You know, it's now one story that we hear a lot all the time is, oh, my case manager won't talk to me. My case manager doesn't like me. My case manager's lazy. My case manager doesn't do their job, et cetera, et cetera. And that may be, look, it could be true, right? But this is one of the things that we do by providing that date empowers you, the family, it empowers the inmate to know, okay, so this is the actual deal. This is what I need to really get on case management staff.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I need to do write other cop outs or whatever, or hire.
Or just ask advocates. The question at team. Are you going to be submit? You know, you made a recommendation. Are you submitting my paperwork now or after I go to the 15-day rate and my conditional release date changes? In that case, you're not challenging the case manager. You're just asking, hey, are you going to wait and file it? Or do we need to do it now? And you're going to reach out to the reentry office to correct the date. By you having that conversation with the case manager in a polite, professional way, not only are you advocating for yourself, and Bruce and I are huge advocates of being self-advocates. We can do a lot from the outside, but the best strategy is when the individual is self-advocating from the inside and we're advocating externally. That's what the best strategy is. And as an individual, you just knowing what your dates are, what your dates will be, and then asking the questions. You know, it's self-advocacy, but it also lets your case manager, unit manager, the case manager coordinator, everyone in your circle know that you understand FSA. You understand how it impacts your life. And that's one of the things that we believe is so important. So, because at the end of the day, it's not our lives. It's your loved one's lives. It's for the incarcerated individual, it's their life. And they need to be kind of masters of their own universe. You don't get to control a lot of things when you're in prison, but knowledge is something you do control.
Right. And it does help many times to have the family and the inmate advocating for himself, but also have us advocating in case there's a fracture, in case something goes wrong. There's been some fractures recently with some RDAP cases and others that Susan had to respond to officials above and beyond to get the attention to the fracture, because now the person could be losing time off of the benefit that they earned. So, and that's very helpful for us to be able to do that. That's why people hire us, because we have the capability and know how to do that in a manner where then sector chiefs and beyond will get the ball rolling. And had the inmate just been doing the administrative remedy or whatever, or talking to the halfway house or talking to the institution staff, might not have happened. Nothing might.
And we try
to be dead honest with you.
Absolutely. And our goal is to avoid the administrative remedy process, because the administrative remedy process by design is a slow, time-consuming process, can take upwards of 6 months to go through the entire process and maybe never get what you need. We actually elevated a case to the region, and we're getting ready to elevate it again because the institution has been non-responsive. And it was one of these situations where the individual has not yet had a recommendation, trying to have a conversation with his unit team about his release needs. And the case manager, not the unit team, the case manager said, oh, this is all you're getting. Well, that's like not how the process works. And he's been trying. He's been following our steps, our guidance in terms of communication internally. And we had to elevate the case to the region to finally get the institution to respond. And now they responded, but then they haven't done anything. So we're going to be elevating it again, because the institution's response was, he can just file administrative remedy. And we're like, what do you mean? There's been no decision. They're not doing anything. Because an administrative remedy, there has to be a decision, and you're grieving a decision. So that's what we see. One of the challenges we see is case managers are telling individuals things. You're going to get this. You're going to get this. But nothing is being documented on their team sheet. And therefore, there is not a formal decision made. And that's how unfortunately, some folks are getting around this.
At the end of the show, check your phone. I sent, actually, there's a correspondence that's happened on that.
On that case? Okay.
Yeah, check your phone at the end of the show. Anyway.
I will do that. Yeah, that one is a little irritating. We'll just leave it at that. So another question they talked about was the question of, and I'm actually going to back up. So the question was, is once the paperwork's been signed by the warden, what happens next? I think we should, hit my microphone there. Let's back up from that. What is the process from the unit team making the recommendation, whether it's made on time or not, from the unit team making the recommendation to getting it to the warden, right? Because there's a whole bunch of work that has to happen. Now, it is the 21st century. It's 2026. This is all done electronically now. It's not like back in the day when I was a case manager where it was all done by paper. So the case manager has to generate what's called a referral packet. And that referral packet includes the pre-sentence investigation report for the individual, the judgment and commitment order. It includes a progress report. The progress report should cover the individual's conduct. Have they had any incident reports? Their programming, what was recommended, what have they done, what haven't they done? Their reentry needs. The progress report should be reflective of what does the person need. This is an area where I have some heartburn with. We've seen enough that we're completely generic, as if the case manager is just doing a block copy paste from one individual to the next. And then they do a referral for the specifics for the individual, and the information on the referral doesn't match the progress report. That's a problem. But we won't get into that today. So we've got the referral, we've got the progress report, we've got the supervised release plan. The supervised release plan is a one-page document that essentially just addresses the person's proposed address and the person's proposed employment plan. This could be an actual job or just a to be secured in this field, right? If the case manager is doing a good job, and I say this with 10 years as a case manager and 11 as a case management coordinator, the case manager should be talking to the individual, even if they don't have a job lined up. What kind of job are you going to look for? You know, and then when they say anything, great, I know you need to be employed, but if what would your druthers be? You looking to go into food service? You looking to go into construction? Like, what are you interested in? And when I would do it as a case manager, I was looking at the pre-sentence investigation report. I was looking at their employment history background, their skills. If they didn't have a whole lot, I was looking at their work record in the prison system. Have they completed their GED? I was asking those questions because sometimes folks would come into my office and the plan they had was, let's just say, less than realistic. I used to joke everyone that come into my office was going to be a music promoter, a sports promoter, or an author. Not saying those aren't legitimate professions, but I need to know what you're going to do between getting out of prison and becoming a sports promoter that making money that you can live on, right? So good case managers are talking to the individuals on the caseload about that. But that's that supervised release plan. It's a one page, a copy goes in the referral, but more importantly, a copy goes out to the U.S. probation office, right? That sometimes, a lot of times we'll hear families say on the website, probation visited my home and approved me for home confinement, or the families said they've, how long now? Great question. The problem is that probation office has gotten that supervised release plan probably before the reentry office actually opened the referral. So they're scheduling, they're looking at the date, they're scheduling, they're doing their thing. They're making notifications, but that's not a good, that, I mean, it's important. You should know, you should be able to document if you're calling us and asking for help. One of the things we ask is, has probation visited? And then our next question is when, and what did they say? So there's going to be this kind of dual track going on. But once they get this packet together and then they put a form referral that kind of summarizes everything, that goes together. It goes from the case manager to the unit manager. From the unit manager, it goes over to correctional systems. Correctional systems, the records office, will run a wants and warrants check. They're going to make sure that the individual doesn't have any kind of unresolved charges, violations, anything hanging out there, which could result in their arrest. We have a case right now, kind of a difficult one. A wanton warrants was ran and there was nothing there. And the individual goes out to halfway house, is doing fine, got the job, doing everything they're supposed to do. And then their case got flagged. And now they have a technical escape incident report, which was not their fault. And in this particular situation, there was a breakdown of communication within the institution and the prior institution. He should have never gone to halfway house, but there was a breakdown of communication. We're working with him and his family right now, but that is a really serious situation. Now, in this person's case, it was federal, but here's what happens if you get arrested and it's a state charge. In theory, the state may charge you, they arrest you, they charge you, and they bond you out to go back to the feds. Best case scenario, that's what happens. You still have a technical escape. You're still going to be sanctioned for having a technical escape. Sometimes those arrests are new arrests. And sometimes I've seen it happen, not frequently, but over the years I've seen it. Guy goes to go get his driver's license. And just in case you didn't know, the reason there's law enforcement in every DMV hanging out in the corner somewhere is because when you're getting your driver's license, they're also doing a wants and warrants check. So if you come back flagged because you went to get your driver's license and there is a warrant, the officer in the corner of the room will come over and will arrest you. Sometimes those warrants, those local warrants, don't get properly added into the system so that at a national level, everybody can see them. Sometimes they're local jurisdiction warrants and nobody finds out about them until you go to the DMV. So if they hold you, you are now not in bureau custody. You are in state custody, which means your federal time stops. So you're sitting over in a city jail or a county jail for 4 or 5 days before they release you so you can go back to the halfway house and say, no, I'm right here. That 4 or 5 days, that's not federal time. And if they hold you to prosecute you and they don't release you back, your federal time stops, which means whenever that gets done, you're still going to owe the feds time. Very problematic. Very problematic. So we go to the records office. Once it clears the records office, it's a quick trip to the case management coordinator, the associate warden, and then up to the warden. The bulk of the slowdown as it gets to the different levels is prior to records office. Gets to the warden. And of course, as I said, now it's all electronic. Back in the day, we had paper files that routed from one office to the other. Right? And you put them in the mailbox and then you go to the next box. Now it's all done electronically. As a CMC, I would hit it. Then it comes into my queue. I review it. I digitally sign it, move it to the next office, the AW at that point in time. So when the warden gets it and the warden signs it, his signature, her signature creates an automatic sending. So when you are, when you're asking your case manager and you're talking to your case manager about when was my packet sent? And sometimes when we see this a lot, we get the question, well, my case manager says it's done, which is cool. Except that the next question is, what do you mean done? Do you mean it's done, the case manager has finished it and they've now sent it routing? Or does the case manager mean it's done, right? And the warden has signed it. Now, I typically am of the opinion it should be able, a packet from the time it leaves the case manager to the time it gets to the warden should take no more than 2 weeks. Now, one of the downsides of everything being digital is back in the day when we did things by paper, if, and I'm going to grab a folder off my desk. Let's see. Probably like, oh, this one. Okay. So I don't know if you can see, like, that's a pretty thick folder, right? If this folder is sitting on my desk, or I have 5 or 10 of these thick folders on my desk, I'm going to see them and I'm going to be like, oh man, I got to get these done. When it's digital and it's in my queue, it's literally in an email box. And I get an email notice that says, oh, Jones, 12345-007. It's in there because I get an email notice telling me that there's a packet in my queue. So sometimes, this is the downside of digital, you can get packets stacked up and not be paying. And if you're not paying attention, unlike when you're pulling them out of your mailbox and you've got 10 stacked up next to you, it's kind of an out of sight, out of mind. So while it should be able to move from the case manager to the warden within 2 weeks, it could take longer. It could be 3 to 4 weeks. So again, knowing when the case manager finished and when the warden signed it is really important. Now, I wouldn't be, you know, I won't be, I'm not going to tell you, run to your case manager and check every week. Because again, once the case manager says, yep, I finished it, it's routing, wait at least 2 weeks. Because 2 weeks is a legitimate period of time. Past 2 weeks, I would be checking on it weekly. Because past 2 weeks means it's stuck in someone's queue and someone's not paying attention. Plain and simple. So again, 2 to 4 weeks to make it from the case manager to the warden. Now let's back up one from that. How long should it take a case manager to get it done? If the case manager has nothing on their desk, you could complete a referral, especially now electronically, where I'm not having to pull files and go to the copy machine and make copies of stuff. You could get a referral. If I've got everything ready, I've got your release plan, I've sent your medical clearance, I've got everything ready to go, I could get a referral done in 30 minutes, 40 minutes. That's if I have nothing else to do. If you're at a camp, realistically, that case manager has 30 to 35 halfway house packets at any given time, maybe more depending on the size of their caseload that they're working on. When a unit team is making a recommendation, the individual needs to keep in mind, when are they going? By policy, a case manager has to finish the packet 60 days. It has to leave the institution 60 days prior to the requested date. So you get a case manager who's doing the right thing, made a recommendation 17 to 19 months in advance of the conditional placement date. Individual has everything kind of in order and is being referred for direct home confinement. Because of the length of their sentence, that's 6 months, right? So that means they are anywhere to 10 to 12 months out from their transfer date. It's unrealistic to think that the case manager is going to do your packet immediately. Because realistically, if your packet isn't due for 10 to 12 months, realistically, they probably have 50 people ahead of you. Very realistic. So kind of keeping that in mind. This is where we coach our clients to ask those questions. Hey, I know, you know, based on this recommendation, my home confinement date, we're in August the 26th. I'm not even going to go until September of 27. I don't want to bug you about it. When do you think you might be working on my packet? Because I know I'm still 13 months out. Ask the case manager. That's a legitimate thing to do. Communication is a beautiful thing. So ask the case manager about it and then hold them accountable to that. If the case manager says, you know what, I know how many I've got and how many more I'm expecting, I'm planning to have yours done probably right around springtime, right? You know, right around the beginning of March. I've got this many on my plate right now. It's going to be March. Okay. I'll wait until I see you. You know, we're going to go to team in, I'll be back. My next team's in April. I'll check in April with you. That's a great strategy. And then come April, because they told you March, by April, it should be done. Right? It should be. And that's where paying attention, staying on top of things is important. Okay, so we talked about how long it takes for the case manager to get done, how long it takes from the case manager to the warden. So we already said it's an electronic submission. So the minute the warden affixes the electronic signature, it automatically goes to the reentry office. The reentry office then uploads it into their reentry system, and their reentry system is separate from the institution system. Why? Because the reentry offices work with contractors, and contractors aren't allowed to have the same access that internal employees have access to. So reentry has this intermediate system that provides information to the contractors that they're allowed to have while still holding back the information that they're not allowed to have. So they upload into their system and they start processing it. Depending on the location, and this part really hasn't changed, even with the digital advancements, you should expect a placement to take 4 to 6 weeks. Now, if you're going to maybe a medium-sized area, not like an LA or Chicago, but, you know, kind of a medium-sized area that has a decent-sized halfway house. You're not out in the middle of Timbuktu, but you're also not in a large urban center. 4 to 6 weeks is reasonable. If you're in a little bit smaller area, again, not remote, a little bit smaller area, you may even get a referral date back closer to 4 to 5 weeks. If you're looking at a major metropolitan area that may have significant bed space issues in terms of because they have just larger numbers of individuals coming back, it may take 6 to 8 weeks, and it could take longer. That's why the sooner a case manager is able to get it done, the better. But that's why the policy timeline is 60 days, 2 months, 8 weeks, because nearly every scenario, except for the weird stuff, can be taken care of in that 60-day window and get a placement date back and do the furlough transfer and move you to halfway house. So ballpark figure 4 to 6 weeks. Could be less, could be more. Now, what about those ones that are in remote areas? What do we do with them? It's a very good question, because home confinement is, for the most part, ran out of the halfway house programs. Except you have to come back to the halfway house every single week. And what if your home is 300 or 400 miles from the nearest halfway house? And it happens, right? We have some of those northwestern kind of states, Idaho, Nevada's in that group, Montana, like, they don't have a lot of halfway houses. That's just the reality. I think Nevada, what did we say? Nevada has 2. And if you're not in one of those areas, down south or almost all the way north, like, you're out of luck, right? The Bureau contracts with federal probation for federal location monitoring. That's a form of home confinement that's under the authority of U.S. probation. So instead of dealing with the halfway house while you're in home confinement, you're dealing with federal probation. You're not on federal probation. You are still a Bureau inmate, but your home confinement is being supervised by federal probation. And those are used in a lot of those remote locations because, again, there's more probation offices than there are halfway houses. So that's that. So we kind of got that timeline. We've talked about that. I'm looking at my time. Okay, we're doing okay. We've talked about that timeline of when recommendation should happen. But what are the things that screw up a timeline? Bruce and I, all the time, when we're talking to a new client, We ask, what district were you sentenced in and where are you going to? By law, the Bureau must release you to your sentencing district or an approved relocation district. Now, if you were living in Dallas, I'm going to use Dallas. You were living in Dallas when you got in trouble, but your family has relocated and you're living in Waco. They're living in Waco now. You can go to Waco. You don't have to go back to Dallas, but Waco is also in the Northern District of Texas. So is Waco is, huh? Am I wrong? Did I lie?
Waco.
Yeah. I was like, no, I was really practicing that to make sure I had my geography right. So
barely.
As long as you're still in the Northern District of Texas, you're okay. You don't have to go back to the city you got in trouble in. But if you're looking to move to a different district, if your family, if you just got busted on I-95 heading north and you were busted in Maryland, but you're really from Georgia, if you were prosecuted in Maryland, but you want to go to Georgia because that's home, or maybe your family has moved. Maybe you were busted out in California, but your family has relocated to Omaha, wherever. If you're releasing to a different sentencing district, you go through what's called a relocation request. And in those situations, your case manager prepares a relocation packet that includes your pre-sentence investigation report, your judgment and commitment order, your supervised release plan, and a progress report. And they throw a cover letter on it and they say, hey, while he was sentenced in this district, he plans to reside. This is his proposed release plan with this family member. And then that probation office for the proposed address will go visit your family member. And then it's their discretion to approve it. We had a client that went through 3 or 4 relocation attempts. I lost track. And each probation office had a different reason for not accepting him. And it was their call. The Bureau has no control over that. Now, one of the problems was there was issues with the person's case. There was in some cases it was the case, some places it was the resident plan, who they were planning to reside with. But again, if you're in that situation, that whole process needs to be successfully completed before the halfway house process can even start. Because in the case of a relocation, the copy of that approval letter from probation goes into the referral packet. A halfway house, a reentry manager will not accept placing you in a proposed relocation district unless probation has already approved it. So again, if you're walking in the door and you don't have a 36, 48 month sentence, and you know you're going somewhere else, you come in with a little 18, 24 month sentence, and I know you might be sitting there going, little, that's 18, 24 months of my life. But when it comes to the government and paperwork, 18 months is like nothing. But if you're walking in the door and you know you are not going back to this relocation, to this sentencing district, you need to be talking to your case manager at your first team. That's important. What else can screw up your timeline? RDAP. I shouldn't say screw up. It can advance your timeline. Again, paying attention to those dates. We had a question, and this we're seeing inconsistently followed across the country. RDAP placement, getting interviewed. And this is not on the psychologists and the DTS because they're not case managers. But if you're looking at a conditional release date of getting a full year off your sentence plus halfway house placement, and now you're saying, I also have this substance abuse issue and I want to be interviewed to take the RDAP program, they should be looking at that earliest conditional date based on FSA, because if you're also eligible for early release benefit, that changes that whole timeline. So if they're not paying attention to those FSA conditional placement dates, you might not get in as fast as you need to get into the program. You're, you know, they're looking at you and they're looking at your release date and they're like going, oh, you're 3 years out. You're 4 years out. But now you add on the FSA and the conditional, the early halfway house. Now that date starts moving up. Now, if you're also eligible for 3621E benefits, like that timeline is crunching, and it's crunching fast. So again, being aware of those kind of scenarios, and as we talk about mapping out your sentence and when do I need to be asking these questions and not just waiting and hoping that a case manager or a DTS asks you about it. Again, taking control of the things you can take control of, self-advocating is so, so important. So that's how the RDAP, and again, we're seeing inconsistent application of RDAP personnel paying attention to those conditional dates. So if someone gets some pushback, I would be politely bringing my FSA worksheet with me and saying, well, I know my good conduct time or my current projected release date is this, but this is going to be my date. And this is when I'm going to be going to pre-release under FSA. If I don't get into halfway, if I don't get into RDAP, I'm not going to have time to get in. And so that's important. Bruce, you look like you were going to jump in and say something, and I cut you off.
No, I'm good. I had some microphone issues.
Oh, okay. Okay, so we have talked about...
4 minutes left, so...
Yeah. We have four minutes. Okay, let me look at what's something... Okay, last thing I'm going to say, there's some other questions in here, and they're all really good, but one of the questions, and we ask these questions, and when we're working with our clients, we actually say, request a copy of your halfway house referral. And what FSA information should be on their halfway house referral for the reentry office to give an accurate date, to designate the individual accurately. And this is where we talk about they should have your conditional release date should be on the paperwork. And if the paperwork was submitted with an FSA conditional release date based on the 10-day rate and not the 15-day rate, that's significant. In fact, it can add up pretty quickly. I mean, we've seen cases where, you know, maybe they were looking at direct home confinement and okay, it was the difference of 30 days or, you know, 20 or 30, or maybe it was 45 days. It's not a huge advancement. But again, is getting to home confinement 30 days sooner important to you? Yes, it is.
Should be.
Absolutely. It should be. Right. Again, we encourage all of our clients to, when the case manager says, oh, it's done, warden signed it, it's with the reentry office, now we're just waiting on them. We encourage all of our clients ask for a copy. That is permissible per the inmate central file policy statement. It is a permissible, releasable document. Every single person should ask for that, just like they should get copies of their team sheets, their FSA worksheets, their pattern risk assessment. All of those things, there is no reason an individual cannot have access to their BP-210. That's the official BP-A0-210 is the official form number, but it is their halfway house referral document. So again, super important. So we've tackled a lot, but everything that we've talked about, typical timelines, atypical timelines, relocation, all of these things are chapter by chapter covered in the Red Book. So it is very much worth it. You can purchase it for yourself. You can purchase it through Amazon and send it directly to your loved one. It is published via Kindle Direct. So that is qualifies as a publisher by policy to receive a softback book directly. So that's it. That's what I got.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Another great episode today, folks. Come by our Facebook group, early release, First Step Act, early release. Also come by our YouTube channel, First Step Act. Catch all these episodes there and also archived here on LA Talk Radio, also on Apple Podcasts. So check us out. Ask us questions. We're always glad to receive questions from our viewers. We like that. And join the Facebook community, man. It's a wonderful community. A lot of supportive people there. All right. Well, everybody, thanks for tuning in today, and have a blessed and safe week. And we'll see everybody here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody.
Have Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Gittings, only on LA Talk Radio.